This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast. I'm John Burke, and with me from across the pond is Matt Hudson from whatiwatchtonight.co.uk. Matt, how's it going?
I'm doing very well, my friend. I put my hand on a freezing cold lamppost the other day and it burnt, and I wondered if I had any salt for that burn. I don't know. Oh. It works in my head, but I didn't touch a dirty lamppost. Don't worry about that, guys. Poor puns aside, doing very, very well, my friend. Looking forward to diving into tonight's film, a film which really don't know what JB thinks about it, and you know, it's causing ripples across the film community. But the one opinion I need is John Burke's, but we'll get to that shortly. I'm doing okay though, my friend. It's Christmas jumper week over in the UK, certainly at work. I'm staring at my Christmas jumper now. It's the new Ghostbusters one. It's a new numbskull Ghostbusters Christmas jumper. It looks great. I'll send you a picture off air, JB. So okay. I'm going to be staring at that the whole time and listening to your voice in my ears. So what could be better whilst we talk film? But before we do that, how are you? Are you keeping Florida safe and well?
Yeah, you know, it's starting to feel a little like Christmas. We've had a warm front, as Florida does, and today was like the first taste of cold weather since Thanksgiving. So I'm hoping that it's going to actually get chilly before. We still have several weeks to Christmas, of course, folks. We are recording this on December 5th. You might be listening to this on December 5th or 6th or 7th. But, for me, it's about that time for Christmas vacation. And so I'm like, you know, all my classes are kind of winding down. I'm getting emails and some thank yous, some, you know, FUs and, you know, those things, because college students, you know, they're like stressing out. Some are done. Some are like, oh, this was easy. And others are like, oh my God, this was the hardest class ever. I don't try to make it hard, mind you. It's just, some people are really comfortable with computers and other people are not. And it definitely, and taking an online class when you're not comfortable with computers is a double the challenge, right? Like it's a lot to overcome. So, I'm also, like swimming in FYC, movies. I've been like watching stuff like crazy. Where like on Saturday, my wife and I went, to a Christmas, like it was supposed to be a Christmas outdoor activity thing. It didn't really feel Christmassy in any way, but it was at this, we've never been, it was almost an hour and 20 minutes away. This Pioneer Museum, right? Like they had all these old buildings, and then it was supposed to be, again, a Christmas festival. Nothing about it felt like Christmas to me. I was a little bummed by that, but, this isn't my, my Bloody Awesome, so I'll share it now. And I just remembered a major part of what happened there is my Bloody Awesome. So I'll hold that detail for now. I don't know what it was, if it was the drive or if it was just being outside, because it was, again, it was like, it wasn't 90 degrees, but it kind of felt like it was a 90 degree day because it had been cold for weeks beforehand, and then it just wasn't. And we was outside and we were walking around, and then we went to a restaurant that was like way too crowded, and very nice waitress, but she was not good at the same time. You know, like you couldn't be mad at her because she was friendly and nice, but like you're also like, get me the napkins you promised me. Like, where are the napkins, lady? Are you making them? Like, yep. And by the time we got home Saturday, I was like exhausted. Like I went to bed at like 10 o'clock on a Saturday. I don't go to bed at 10 o'clock on a normal night, much less do I usually on a Saturday.
It does sound like a dream though. For two guys who go to bed very late, it does sound a dream.
But so I was just like, you know what? I'm tired. I'm not going to watch a movie. I was out all day. But then I watched three movies on Sunday. So like it balances out. So like it's just so many movies to catch up on. I'll talk about several of them briefly because there's just too many to go into detail with. You know, getting ready for awards because on the 15th, the vote opens up for the Critics Association of Central Florida. And I want to make sure I have covered all of my bases. You know, one of the bonuses of being a critic is we get a lot of, you know, we don't make money doing this really, but some do. Some out there make some money. We don't. I'd love to. If anyone wants to pay us, that'd be incredible. But we get swag, though, and I do like the swag. And today I got a Barbie screenplay book.
Sweet.
You know, they're pushing for the best screenplay, and it's cool to have a book. Like, it's paperback, but nevertheless, it's, you know, a bound book with the cover. It's gold. It came in a gold bubble envelope. And I was like, what's this? Oh, Barbie screenplay. All right, cool. So, you know, little things like that are cool parts of this time of year. I've got to benefit from the last few years from it, and it's more and more. Like, we're getting a lot more stuff this year. I have so many discs. And a time where physical media seems threatened, it's cool getting some of these movies on a disc that I have to destroy. Yeah. But nevertheless, like currently I have it physically in hand. I'm like, oh, that's cool.
I'm glad. I've always enjoyed how in order to curry favor, they just send free stuff. And like you, yeah. I am here for that. I am the, would I sell my soul out for a Kenner-G fleece? Probably. So if you're listening, Warner Brothers, I'm still available for that. And
do you know I have one?
I do know you have one, which is good because I was going to send you one for Christmas. I'm glad that you have one.
Tuna got one for CCA, and he gifted it to me. Thank you, Tuna, as for so many things, but specifically that hoodie, which I haven't got to wear yet because it's been 80 degrees. I'm hoping it's going to be cold so I can actually wear it.
You're a good man, Tuna. Well, I'm going to get one, whether it's from Warner Brothers or via their official site, and we can both wear it at the same time, John, because I've heard from very reliable sources that they're very warm and cozy. But
and we can sing the Feifel song, you know, under the same moonlight.
Yes, and we can look at this could be great. Cinematography could be on point, and this could be a viral hit for the Bamp Boy. I can see it already, but this is like Christmas for film fans, man, or critics. Yes, we've got the votes coming up. Central Critics Association of Florida. I have the UK Film Critics Association to vote on soon, and IFSCA as well. And then, of course, leading up to the golden statues everybody wants, the Bampies, coming at the beginning of January. So, yeah, I'm trying to cram in as much as possible. Still not getting to the levels of cramming that I would like, but in time that will come. I've got more time off work coming up soon. I've got a few days off, a few childless days as well in the next few days, next week or so. So I do intend on filling them with film, because what better way of escapism or achieving escapism than by film? Isn't that correct, John?
That is correct. Exactly. And speaking of film, we should probably get into this week's movie. Matt kind of stumbled into it if you were paying attention, listeners, although it's possible that if you are a more casual moviegoer listening to this podcast, you may not have heard of this movie because it doesn't have a super wide release just yet, although it is expanding out this week. The film is called Saltburn. It is written and directed by Academy Award nominated Emerald Fennell. You might have seen her movie A Promising Young Woman in 2020, I believe. This film is star-studded, though. So if you haven't heard of this, you still might be interested because there's a lot of cast. However, caveat going forward, this movie is 100% not for everybody. And if you look at when we go over the stats here in a second, you might think I'm wrong, because they're pretty high for a movie that I would say is not for everyone. But there are some definite sequences in this movie that will make even the most comfortable audience members uncomfortable. I at least think so. Anyways,
go and watch it with your parents, guys.
Yes, yeah. Watch it with your parents. Watch it with your grandparents. Make sure you take them to the movie, especially if they don't go very often. No, yes. Listen to Matt. Here's the cast. Barry Keoghan, which I know that's not how you say his name.
Barry Keoghan.
It is
Keoghan. You are correct.
You do hit the O. Okay. See, I feel like that's just me being an American, but no. All right, Barry Keoghan, who I just want to say right at the top, I am a huge fan. I have enjoyed almost every one of his movies. I can't think of one I don't like. We had the Banshees last year where he was incredible. The 2 seconds he's in, the Batman. I love Killing of a Sacred Deer, which is a very similar character to this character, though. But we also get Jacob Elordi, who, Matt, we covered Kissing Booth 1 and 2 on this podcast.
Don't remind me.
If you told me that we would be talking about that guy with reverence a few years later, I would have probably laughed. Because
he's doing everything he can to get out of the shadow of those films.
Dude, I mean, this year alone, Priscilla and this movie, I'm just like, wow, I totally would not have guessed that dude from Kissing Booth was capable of this type of performance. Yeah. You get Rosamund Pike just having a blast, I think. Archie, this is the dude from Gran Turismo, 2 movies this year. There you go, that guy. Richard E. Grant, Allison Oliver, Carrie Mulligan is barely in this movie, but she is great when she's on screen. And then there's a bunch of other people listed, but I think they're just kind of in the background in scenes. So I'm going to stop with Carrie. So I really like Promising Young Woman a lot. And apparently, I've learned through some of the critics that I listen to or read were not fans of that movie, and I was kind of stunned because it was an Oscar nominee. It was in 2020. And apparently a lot of people, I always knew that people had problems with the ending of Promising Young Woman. Mm-hmm. And I don't, like, I wouldn't, I'm not going to be like, oh, I think it's the best ending ever. But I was shocked by the ending. Like, it landed, right? Like, I did not see it coming. And I thought it was a interesting and unexpected way to end that film. I thought Carey Mulligan was great, which I have become a huge Carey Mulligan fan over the last couple of years, too. I mean, I'd seen her in things and just didn't acknowledge who it was. Obviously, you know, she's in Drive, she's in Inside Llewyn Davis, but that movie's where I think the first time I saw her as the lead, right? Like, she is the force in that film. And I have now, like, if she's in something, I'm in 100%. Like, I want to be there for her performances. The movie is this: a student at Oxford University finds himself drawn into the world of a charming and aristocratic classmate who invites him to his eccentric family's sprawling estate for a summer never to be forgotten. That is not an accurate depiction of what this movie is.
Like, it sounds like a comedy type thing, doesn't it? Like a drunken comedy film.
Well, and it covers more than a single summer. Like, it covers a lot of time. The summer is one part of the time. It's also 2006, and I think that should be in the synopsis. I think that's a relevant point. Yes. This is a period piece. This is 2006 in Oxford at first. The ratings, 71% RT, which I checked this morning. I had it at 70. It's gone up a point since I initially built the show notes. 77 RT audience score, which that shocked me. I would not have guessed the critics and the audiences would feel the same about this movie. And I'm sure far less audience members have seen it than usual because it is an unlimited release. So that number will probably go down a little. I think this will hit some audiences will be offended by a lot of what this movie is bringing to the table. 60 Metascore, 7.5 IMDb user score. Again, those scores are always really hard to judge on IMDb, but 3.7 Letterboxd I also found a little surprising because the critics that I listened to, Blank Check, which I've been talking about for I don't know how long now on this podcast, the guys don't seem to like Fennell's movies. I've recently become a big fan of The Big Picture Show, which is they're also friends with Blank Check. That's how I found that podcast. So maybe similar circles, similar things. But the thing is, the reason why I connect with Blank Check so hard is I often agree with them. So this is one of those, I wonder why we disagree so hard about Emerald Fennell's films. And I just listened to The Big Picture's episode on Saltburn. They, I have to say, were positive overall.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, think it's kind of trash, right? Like, that's their vibe. So I watched this, and What I think where big picture and I fall in line is that it's this movie's undeniably watchable, mostly because of the cast and the style. Like, this movie, it looks incredible. Like, the fashion, like the set design, the Saltburn, and when it's funny, it's really funny. And she has a really good grasp of dark comedy, in my opinion. I think Promising Young Woman, a movie about rape revenge, has moment. I mean, the opening sequence of her walking with the chili dog, where you think she's killed somebody at first because it looks like she's walking with blood on her legs, but it's chili. Just how that's revealed, I found so. I've never forgotten that opening sequence. It's such a small moment, but I was so like, what am I watching when I was watching it? And I think this movie does that too. There's really funny, dark humor type stuff. Rosamund Pike's character in particular gets some of the funniest lines, and the way her character is, because she's constantly insulting everybody and also like just the worst gossip, but seems to be oblivious and thinks she's a good person. And like the whole presentation of that character, it says a lot. And I do think that's the biggest criticism that I'm hearing about Fennell, is most people think she's shallow in the sense that these movies don't really say anything. And I think when it comes to the audience, that we're able to really project our own interpretations on these really, really hard. And if you are, I feel, because I've read a few reviews where I'm like, wow, that's not how I was looking at it at all. I think that if you come at this with an attitude towards her, it's easier to find flaws in this. And if you are the opposite, if you are kind of coming in like, hey, I found her movie entertaining and crazy and bringing up interesting points, I think you can project positive versions of the interpretation, which is kind of how I fell into this. I found the movie watchable. I think the performances are incredible. I think it looks good. I like this movie. I do think there's some really strong points made that there's nothing really being said, and that I have only seen The Talented Mr. Ripley once, and I was too young to see it. Yeah. I watched it like on HBO. I thought it was weird. I didn't understand. I definitely didn't understand the commentary. It's 99, so I was maybe probably a little bit on the homophobic side of things. So it made me uncomfortable, I think, more so, especially because I had not really been presented with anything like that. And again, this is a vague memory of what that movie even is. I just know now it's getting dramatically compared to this movie, and this movie's wild. I do see the comparisons, even only having seen Talented Mr. Ripley once. The Big Picture Show compared it to a few other things. I read an article from New York Times, and I read the Roger Ebert's website's reviewers. I don't remember the reviewer's name. Sorry. Review also, because she was very positive on it. The New York Times reviewer was very negative on it. And then I feel like The Big Picture was somewhere in the middle. They had a lot of criticism, but still found the movie very watchable. I'm definitely finding the movie extremely watchable. I thought it was very fun, wild, disturbing and troubling. And I think there's some really big swings. I don't know if they all land, but they're so outrageous that it's hard to like dismiss them outright to me. I don't know if Emerald Fennell is trying to say anything relevant. I tried to suss some things out. I think both movies, Promising Young Woman and this, and this is to the Big Picture Show's points. I don't know if I fully understand the character motivations, specifically our quote unquote protagonist. Mm-hmm. Like, why this? Why this particular thing? How did you end up doing this? What was the goal? What's the end game? And if you dive deep enough into that, I don't think the movie's offering much of an answer. And I do think that's a problem, especially if the film is not driven by a particular plot. Like, there's no MacGuffin, really. I mean, he's chasing something, but not in a way that is like a traditional narrative storytelling device of, I want A, this is why I can't have A, what am I going to do to get A? It's not that movie, right? Like, that's not really what's going on. Most of the time, we're kind of in the dark of what he wants or what he's chasing. And the character actually at one point kind of confesses he doesn't even really know for sure what he felt or wanted with one of the quote-unquote MacGuffins here. So I think there's definitely room for improvement. But as a weird, dark comedy with moments that should make anybody squirm, I think. I mean, there's a scene involving Allison Oliver's character Venetia and Barry Keoghan's character Oliver that bothers me still. It's vampire discussions, if you get my drift. But I overall am positive on this. It's not in my top five. It's not in my top 10 for the year, but it is higher up on my list than I think a lot of other people. So I'm mostly positive. Again, I just think these performances are undeniable. I think the weird, quirky comedy works for me. I do feel like Richard E. Grant is underused, though. As a person who tends to like him a lot in movies, he's just like, I feel like he's not doing a lot. And that's not, I don't think it's his fault. I just don't know if the character really needs to be there. In a lot of the moments, he just feels extra. But that's my overall take. Matt, I have also no idea how you felt about this, although I feel like we might be on opposite ends of this one. So I'm curious, what did you think of Saltburn?
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
I do like it when JB gets curious, and I'm going to cut straight to the chase, JB, because I'm actually not a million miles off from you on this, actually. Ah. And whilst you were eloquently describing your thoughts on the film, I was kind of checking things off my notes like, yep, I've got something similar to that, And my kind of like long and short of it is, I don't think this film is, I think this film swings for many, many strikes, doesn't hit all of them. In fact, maybe doesn't hit many of them, but goddamn, is it compelling? I was never not entertained during this film. And that is what the thing I took the most from it. I agree. What are the characters' motivations? Barry Keoghan's character, Oliver, what is, you know, trying to work out his motivations. And by the end of it, when we talk spoilers on the minisode, you can be like, oh, I know what's going on here. But that, I don't think at any point I was sitting there thinking, oh, I get anyone's motivation. In fact, I think that, you know, it's a thriller, it's a drama, it's a comedy. Mystery is a very dark comedy. Mystery. It's kind of jack of all, but master of no trades, as well, I think. Doesn't quite nail any of them particularly successfully. And I don't mean it doesn't do well at all. I mean, it doesn't excel at any. I think, like you, some of the zinger one-liners are superb. You know, there's some fantastic lines in this which made me laugh at things maybe I shouldn't have done. But that is what the whole point of this film is. It's there to get under your skin and make you feel uncomfortable. But I don't think it always lands. The mystery, I don't think there was a mystery whatsoever. The dramatic side of it, for what it's worth, it wasn't there. And the thriller side, you know, it's not thrilling. It's not scary. There's no atmosphere here being built. And it isn't, and don't get me wrong, this isn't a thriller as such. But there are moments in it where you could certainly, as we get further into the film, where you could look at it in that sense. So it doesn't really jump out at anything. And even thematically, it seems a little bit all over the place. I mentioned thriller, so is it like a homoerotic thriller? I don't know. Is it an Oscar bait film? Maybe. Is it this kind of biting commentary on class? I've seen the phrase "eat the rich" thrown around quite a lot. Is it a period piece, which is a contemporary period piece because it's set in 2006, but there's also vibes that it could be set like decades before, given the setting and the way the characters are portrayed, as certainly Rosamund Pike and Richard E. Grant. So there's a lot going on. And again, it's a bit of a mess of a film. And in terms of the class thing, I know people have been speaking about that. I don't think it's the best commentary on class. I think what a lot of people are getting their underwear in a twist about, because I hear what you're saying, a lot of people have suddenly turned on Emerald Fennell. And I really liked Promising Young Woman. Well, I think that's a very, very good film. But I think people are looking at the quotes attributed to Fennell, got to say her name properly, Fennell, about this film, where she says she wanted to sympathise with unlikable people, you know, the sort of people we can't stand, the sort of abhorrent people, you know, these rich people. And I think they're kind of looking at her as if to say, well, your whole life has been, you sit comfortably within the extremely privileged, you know, her father is a jewellery tycoon, you know, she is rich upon rich, fam, never had to worry. So I think people are looking at that and thinking, well, what do you mean? How unlikable people of which you kind of fraternize with, essentially. I don't want to say that is the case, but I think that's what a lot of people's generalizations. And also, how far does she want to kind of push the envelope of poking at the rich when that is her lineage? So I kind of got a little bit of that. And you could look at it as, you know, the evil lower middle class just trying to take what the rich have got. You could look at it like that, or you could not. I think the film actually works a lot better if you just watch it as this kind of sleazy bit of pulp. And I wish the film was just that. I do wish they dispensed with some of the some of the beats throughout and just had this kind of sleazy pulp thriller. Just go for one thing, and that I would have been happy with that, because I think that's where it would have worked. Because the moments you mentioned, JB, or alluded to, they are there to make you uncomfortable. It got to a point where I thought, are they in there just to kind of get that reaction? Because the first one you see, which involves a bathtub, I was like, oh my God, they're really lingering on this shot, and it's really effective. It's, you know, it really made me kind of wince, but it's so effective. Mm-hmm. And then they do it again, and then there's another one later on involving, well, just say the ground. It's like, and it got to that point, and I thought, are we just doing this to be odd, to be like a sensationalist? Is there a point to this? Because the only person who is privy to this is the character who's doing it and the audience. So what is this trying to tell us, other than, oh my God, this is crazy? And I kind of started to feel that the film was trying a bit too hard towards the end. I wasn't the biggest fan of the ending of this film until, well, it's not even the ending, we spoke about this off air, like the kind of reveals and twists that happen. I wasn't the biggest fan because I don't think they were particularly revelatory, and they felt a little bit unsatisfied, underwhelming, I think the word is, underwhelming. But, you know, that aside, because that sounds very negative, I wanted to kind of get that out of the way, that there are ups and downs along the way. I found this extremely compelling throughout, like I said. I think Barry Keoghan is excellent in the lead. I think this is probably his first lead role, like straight up lead role, I think, majority lead. And he is great, like you. Anytime I see his name on the credits, I'm in, because he always brings his A game. Jacob Elordi, I think what he does with the character very well is he could have just played the character off as a narcissist and somebody who is extremely unlikable, but he doesn't. You know, of course he has tendencies, but you see that there's a person there. And I actually will say the same of Rosamund Pike, Richard E. Grant, Reg, and Alison Oliver's character. They're set up to be unlikable, but I think they're just too stupid to be unlikable, and they are played like that. Now, Rosamund Pike is, you know, Richard E. Grant is in, I think he's great in this film. He's in his own world in the film, coming off a kind of a similar performance in The Lesson a few months back as this kind of odd patriarchal figure. But I do think they're so insular and so tuned in only to their own surroundings that's obviously where the dichotomy comes from, that when an outsider comes in, you know, this is where our kind of main crux is. But I actually found myself kind of quite liking the rich family in this, because they were the ones coming out of the best lines. They were giving us these great performances. And I was like, I like these guys, even though I probably shouldn't. So maybe that's the writing, I don't know. But I think the performances were all very, very good. I think the jokes or the gags for the most part are good. I think he gets a little muddled towards the end, but I do think I want to say that the cinematography from Linus Sandgren, Damien Chazelle's collaborator, is very, very good. It's in a 4:3 aspect ratio. Not entirely sure it needs to be, because I actually would have liked to have seen the entirety of these stunning locations. I think the manor house, the mansion it's set in, is only about an hour and a half, 2 hours from where I am. It is very private. I don't think I can just go up and take a picture, but if I'm ever in that area, maybe I will. But I specifically like the lighting in this film. I think it's lit so damn well. Whether it's a close up of somebody's body, or a party scene, or a nighttime scene, or whatever, the lighting tells its own story. I think I really like his cinematographer anyway.
There's a scene, I won't say exactly the context, but the family's at like lunch, and then they close the curtains and it turns the room red. Yeah. That sequence is so cool, like visually.
Visually, and it evokes obviously what's happening in the scene as well. Things take a change. And I mean, you could also compare this. I was going to say, he Whereas I wasn't the biggest fan of Babylon as a film. I think it's shot deliciously. And I think you almost compare these two films essentially for that. The debauchery side of it. But Saltburn, I'd heard it was divisive. I'd heard you either love it or you hate it. I don't know. It seems like we're kind of more on the, we liked it, but we're not quite ready to say, I'm not ready to say I loved it. I'm not going to say I hated it because I didn't. I enjoyed it. I was entertained. I was uncomfortable at times, but the critic in me was left scratching my head a lot of the times, JB, at some of the inclusions of story beats, some of the characters even, the revelations throughout and the muddled thematic jumble that was going on through it. That said, I came out satisfied enough, and that was good enough for me, JB, hearing it was going to be so divisive.
It wasn't as salty as he might have expected. Margot Robbie is a producer on this, by the way, so that another Babylon connection.
I did not know that. Is it? It is Margot Robbie's production company produces this as well, Lucky Chap Entertainment. So another.
I'm looking at Letterboxd and she's just listed. I was like, oh.
Yeah, another Babylon there. But I think she also, Margot Robbie, produced Promising Young Woman along with the Lucky Chap Entertainment production company. So, and listen, Emerald Fennell was getting flack in the media because she talked with a posh accent and she was brought up with riches. Think about that what you will. Not here to talk about that. You know, guys out there, whatever. In terms of filmmaking, I think she's shown here that she's a very, very good filmmaker, very talented filmmaker.
That is one thing that, especially with Promising Young Woman, when like male critics are bashing her, I do always take that with a grain of, I can't even say I take it with a grain of salt. I might immediately assume that they're coming from a place of like defensiveness because of their gender, which might be false, but it I'm so used to men downgrading what women put into the world, especially artistically, that I kind of just make that assumption now, and I shouldn't. It's unfair because, again, that's the exact thing I'm accusing them of doing, is saying it's bad because it's a woman. And obviously there are some critics that are very clearly that's the issue, right? Like there's a difference of maybe that's where you're coming from versus like clearly that's where you're coming from. But I tried to find different perspectives here, and I think it's one of the things I like about the Big Picture podcast, is it's Sean and Amanda Dobbin, Sean Fennessy are the two hosts, and you do have an interesting dynamic in that regard, that you nice. Get two voices. And although I do believe, we need more diversity in our criticism, I think, in general. But I tried to read a few different takes on this to see, because they mentioned her upbringing. And I do think that's relevant, because one of the criticisms that I saw levied that this movie was saying that if you have money, the middle class is evil and they'll come get you. And I'm like, that's a weird read, because I totally read it as eat the rich, which was a common thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, but I didn't know that
where
about
they're coming from with that.
Well, especially idea. Knowing that about her. I think that is a detail that makes, again, that shift in your perspective. If you're just watching this as a person who's like, these wealthy people have everything, and then you watch the way this movie plays out, you might be like, yeah. Then again, if you're aware that the person who wrote it is wealthy, and then you watch the movie play out, you might take a different perspective.
And Barry Keoghan is, you wouldn't tell, because the only thing I can criticize for Barry as if I know him, but is his accent is all over the place. He's obviously an Irish man. He is playing a guy from Liverpool, where the Beatles are from. So he's got a Scouse accent. And that kind of wobbles and wavers. However, it clearly isn't accidental to place Barry Keoghan's character from a place in Merseyside, and the town that is from, or Merseyside in general, is a place where they would see themselves and they would describe themselves. This isn't me saying this. This is kind of in Britain. This is how we know. They would describe themselves very much as hardworking, working class types. So it was a very deliberate decision to give him a Northern Scouse accent as part of the class commentary. And of course, like you said, how the film develops is how the film develops. We'll talk about that in the coming days. But there is a class commentary here. I don't think it's particularly done very well, but I think that's more for me, because I'm not entirely sure what the film is trying to say. You know, yeah. I don't know. It's also like a noir film in time. One of our main characters, should we say, could be like a femme fatale, which is cool. But then it just adds another layer to the film where there's not much going on underneath it. Whereas I think it could have worked best for me, and it's subjective, just as a kind of sleazy, pulpy thriller. Just go for that instead, and let's leave everything else at the door. But again, Emerald Fennell has shown that she has, I think this is a, in terms of execution, I think this is actually a step up from how, from Promising Young Woman in terms of the filmmaking, as like an evolution you'd think it would be. She's done Promising Young Woman, she's worked on her craft, mm-hmm. honed it. I think this film is shot better, I think it looks better. And I don't think you can deny that she's got an eye for making good films, good-looking films, at least.
I think my final like takeaway from this is maybe she should try making someone else's movie or collaborating with a second person, mm-hmm. to maybe help with character motivation or like her structure is kind of off a little bit. Yeah, and or you know, one of the things that I've struggled every time I've attempted to even write a review, sometimes I don't have anything that I feel is like worth bringing to the table, yes, right? Like, yeah. It's like, I'm just going to have these superficial, artificial comments like, oh, I thought this was fun.
Yeah. It's just, but
I don't have a deeper reading on it. And it's hard to like, I know that, like, I'm aware that I have nothing really new to say. And that's, partly why I listened to some other people for this one. Cause I was like, I liked it, but I don't know if I have a take on it. And the reason is maybe because she didn't have a take on it, so there wasn't really one for me to pull.
I think you're right. I liked it. I didn't love it, but I'm not entirely sure I can put my finger on what is going on, other than when we talk spoilers, we can obviously say what happened. But
there's a lot of things I definitely want to like. How did you react to A? And I can't say that without it.
I liked it, JB. I actually thought, I'm not going to lie, I did go in this thinking, oh, I've heard so much about this, and people in my critic groups are saying it is the worst film of the year, and you know my thoughts on that. That kind of hyperbole can get it in the bin. Every week we have a best or worst film of the year, but I was pleasantly surprised, if anything.
I watched, we got links for this for FYC,
yes.
But Tuna was already going to see it in the theater before we knew the link was coming in, but like I watched it while he was at a theater watching it, and so I was about to say I had his reaction first, but this is one of his favorite films of the year.
Man, that's classic Tuna though, isn't it?
Yeah, but I'm closer to him than not, though. You know what I'm saying? Like, this isn't, it's not in my top five, but it, like, I was like, man, if this had a couple of extra little things, if it had clicked just a little harder, because I was really up on Promising Young Woman. Like, that movie really worked for me in a lot of ways. And now I'm like, is that bad that it worked for me? Like, it didn't work. Like, I wasn't like...
This, you know, just has too much going on, I think. It doesn't need to have as much as it has.
She does have
on.
A really good grasp of comedy, though, which is interesting because the two movies she's made shouldn't be comedies, but they are. And I do have a dark sense of humor, so like I can't resist when one works. That said, folks, that's our review of Saltburn. Check back in a couple days for the spoiler mini. So as long as you are following us or subscribe to us on whatever podcast catcher you get, you'll get that bonus episode for no additional charge. Of course, there's no charge for this either, but you get, there's still no additional. It's accurate. It's time we switch segments, though. It's Concessions of a Cinephile. If you're new to the show, or if you're a longtime listener, maybe you missed the last couple episodes. You haven't heard this new segment, but we got rid of Chopped Headlines and we've replaced it with our version of Water Cooler Talk. This is, imagine you're in line, you're about to get some popcorn, you're about to go see that new movie, but there's a bunch of other cinephiles around you for a change. It's not just those people who only watch movies sometimes. It's other people who spend the time going to the theater. Now's your chance to talk cinema. That's what this is. These are concessions of a cinephile. And this week, because it's December, we want to talk holiday movies, because holiday movies have a weird place in how we consume media. Because Matt, I think you're like me. Obviously, you've rewatched The Exorcist countless times. I have movies on my list that I've watched ridiculous number of times. But I think if I had been accurately counting since I was a little kid, I feel like the number of movies I've seen the most would all be Christmas movies, because every year I return to the same films. Every once in a while I get to add a new one to that list, right? Like, but generally speaking, since I was like 8 years old, I've watched the same Christmas movies every year, and I'm 41 now. So it's a lot of times that I've seen some of these Christmas movies, and some of them I watch more than once a Christmas season. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's some I hit, it's like, okay, I got to check the box. Have I watched this one yet? But others I rewatch multiple times in that one season. And then I've done that multiple times after that. Yeah. So I wish I had an accurate count. I'd love to know how many times have I seen blank. I don't want to say titles yet, because we're about to talk about our favorite holiday films. But I thought we would start with that. Holiday movies have that weird rewatchability that they not only are they, you know, the ones that stick, the ones that we keep coming back to as a culture, they offer something there. But I also think they are given a responsibility of making us feel a certain way, right? Like, we associate, it doesn't feel like Christmas is something I've said before. These movies help us feel like Christmas. They give us that sensation. They put us in a time and place where we get that aspiring feeling of the season that we're supposed to be excited for, that we're supposed to be happy. Obviously there's a lot going on with that. There's music and there's candy and there's decorations, but the movies play a vital role, especially I think for cinephiles, to get us to that point where we are ready for the holidays. And no other movies have that responsibility. I mean, there's other holiday based films, but I don't think we rely on them to give us the feeling like this. Cause I mean, you might argue horror for Halloween, but like, that's a whole genre of like, where it's much more vast, because holiday movies could be a genre and then specifically a subgenre being Christmas film. But I don't know. I've been
more niche.
Yeah. Right. It's very, very narrow. And I think horror movies you can watch year round.
Well, that's exactly it. Horror movies generally you watch speaking, all year round. Yeah.
Yeah. Christmas movies you generally don't. You could, but you generally don't.
It feels sacrilege, doesn't it? Because of what you've just said, it's meant to make you feel festive. And also the majority of Christmas films, I know there are some out there maybe that don't, but the majority are meant to imbue you with hope, with happiness, with a warm feeling. Because even if in the middle section things don't look great for our protagonist or our lead character, by the end you know it's going to be good. They're going to be around the tree on Christmas morning with the family or whatever, whoever they're with, opening presents and whatever. You know you're going to get that, and it makes you feel good. It's that comforting feeling, JB. And that's what I get from like some of the Exorcist comfort film. Some of the films I like as comfort films are more because of what you've just said. I remember watching them as a kid or as a teen, and you kind of go back to those times and what you got from it then. And it is that escapism. We mentioned it up top. There is an escapism in these films, especially holiday films, especially Christmas and festive films. It's not because, oh, I want the life and the house and the Christmas tree those guys have got, but it's no, I can, you know, I can relate to it. It's what's underneath that. It's the family, it's the connection, it's the bonds, it's the warmth and everything that goes along with Christmas. It doesn't matter if you're rich, poor, whatever. It's the feeling. And that's what a good Christmas film should do. Or it should scare you, or it should make you laugh, or it should make you cry. But if we can do all of them, maybe not the scare part, you're laughing. But yeah, holiday films, I know they sometimes get a bit of a bad rap for being cheesy, for being mawkish, for being overly sugary. But hey, what other time of the year can you do it, JB? Your summer blockbusters, big bombastic films, horror, Halloween, they're meant to scare you. Festive films, if there's any time to make a film to hit the heartstrings, it is the Christmas films. And I know you like a Hallmark film, John, so you know all about that. Cool. Or a Lifetime film.
We should say, though, there are Christmas horror films, and I think you and I are both a fan of that subgenre. Yeah. of this subgenre. So what we're going to do, listeners, we're not doing a top list. We're just going to talk about some of our favorite movies. I'm also going to try to throw some curveballs out there. I don't know if we've ever talked holiday movies before. I feel like we've maybe mentioned
them. Really?
We've probably discussed them in what we've been watching or our consumption.
Social posts about it where we've done like our favorite horror holiday film or our favorite, you know, genre holiday film. Yeah. or antagonist, protagonist. But I don't think we've never sat down on a show and spoken about it.
And just, I don't know how this will go in terms of like detail, how much we'll discuss it exactly. But I think I just got a text from Tuna that he's stuck in an elevator. So
horror film.
Yeah, weird timing. Devil, the movie. We're just going to kind of discuss. Now, the way I approach this, with the exception of my first one, is I want to give I want to shine a light on some Christmas movies that maybe aren't in the regular rotation of our listeners. And that maybe you should give a chance, because I do, while I love rewatching Christmas films, sometimes it does feel more like I am doing a checklist. Like, have I watched this yet? Have I watched this yet? And I love when a new one shows up that I can add to that checklist to mix it up a little bit. Right. And like, sometimes I don't like, I might take a Christmas off from one movie and come back to it in a couple years when there are others that I watch all the time. And I real quick, this is a curveball, Matt, so I'll give you a second to think about it. What Christmas movie do you think you've seen the most? I'm going to answer first, so you got a second to think. I don't know if this happens in the UK or not, but I'm okay. Pretty sure when I was like 12 years old, TNT/TBS, which is a channel from here in the States, started doing 24 hours of A Christmas Story, right? So at 8 o'clock on Christmas Eve, they would play A Christmas Story with commercials, but they would start at 8 o'clock on Christmas Eve and it would run until 8 o'clock on Christmas Day. So okay. That's, you know, it's a 2 hour movie, I think, with the commercials. And so you're 2 hour block. So I guess that's, you're going to see it 12 times. And while I would not be awake for all of that, when I was awake, that was on. And they still do that to this day, to my knowledge. I haven't had cable in like 10 years, but they still, I think, do the 24 hours of A Christmas Story. At one point, they were doing that with Elf as well on a different network. But so pretty much from the age of 12 to probably 30, I watched A Christmas Story like 3 to 4 times every Christmas because I would just let it loop. It was Christmas Eve. It was time for A Christmas Story. So I feel pretty confident there is no movie I've seen more than A Christmas Story. I think I've seen it more than any movie ever because I have watched it. And it's I love it. It's not on my list right here to talk about, but it's one to me. It's like such an obvious one because my whole family did that. Like, it was every one of us. We were watching A Christmas Story for 24 hours. And when I was a kid, I thought it was an old movie. Because it's set in the 50s, right? My brain didn't process that it was a period piece. It wasn't until I was me, probably, you know, 20 years ago that I realized, like, wait, this movie's from the 80s? I had no idea. I was alive when it came out. I always just thought it was some old movie that I discovered as a kid. And it's because it also, because it had the cult following, right? Like, it didn't do really well in theaters. It took a few years and then it became this juggernaut of Christmas films. But I think I've seen that more than any movie ever, but it's definitely the Christmas movie I've watched the most. It's not, I love it. It's in my top five because I have that connection to it, but it's not what, I don't feel like I need to like stand on a mountaintop and say it, but is there one for you?
The one that I have seen the most, whether it's intentional or not, usually not, because over here we have, we don't necessarily have a Christmas Carol on loop, but we have specific channels on Sky Movies where it would just be Sky Christmas and it's just Christmas films all year round. But even before that, on your kind of terrestrial TV, your major channels, one film was always on as a kid, and it's Home Alone. Always on as a kid. And I'll throw it out there, that's also on my list. I'll throw that under my first one, JB, for that reason. I mean, I think the film was fun. Is it a great film? Probably not, but it's a mix of the moments of wishing I could be Kevin McAllister or being left alone in that house with a credit card to get that pizza and everything else, that, and in that kind of snow. Yeah, man, that's like the fantasy for a kid. Obviously not being stalked and hunted by burglars, potential murderers. I could probably do without that, but it's the vibe that film gets, the feeling at the end when everyone's back, John Williams' majestic score for that film. Ugh. It's just a wonderfully nostalgic film for me, and I'm sure many others listening as well. But because it was on so much as a kid, it was just always on around the holiday season. And my family would put it on because they enjoyed it. My mum and dad, they'd put it on because they enjoyed it and got a laugh out of it. Because why wouldn't you? The things Kevin does to the Wet Bandits is hilarious. Or the Sticky Bandits, as they become known as well.
Secondly.
Exactly. I'm not a fan of that one, but it's always on. And now if it's on now, I watch it. Sometimes I will actually actively seek it out over Christmas because it just takes me back to the good times. And it's, I wouldn't say it's harmless because it isn't. It's a like mini John Wick, but Home Alone is one of my favorite holiday films. And now I spoke to my kid the other day rang her up and said, you know, what are you watching tonight? Expecting her to say Goosebumps or something again. She loves Goosebumps. She said, oh, I'm watching Home Alone. And I got the pang. I was like, oh, man, this takes me back. I said, what? She said, oh, how'd you hear about that? She said, oh, we just heard about it. She asked her mum and she's, you know, yeah, you can watch it. So I said to her, don't get any ideas and don't be setting up any traps around the house for your mother now.
I don't remember what age Taylor first saw Home Alone, because the Home Alone is also one I've seen a million times. But it was within the first few months. She's probably 5 or 6. We were at Walmart and she'd seen Home Alone, and we're walking through Walmart and she's sitting in the cart. And I'm away. It's like Kathy and her are together, and she just quotes the damn movie and is like, she looks at my wife and goes, "Why the hell did you take your shoes off?" Kathy's wearing shoes, mind you, so there's no context. She just has the line stuck in her head from Home Alone, and that was one of the first times I was like, "Ooh, maybe too young for that." I hadn't thought about it, but
I'm waiting. The moment I'm scared of is waking up in the middle of the night next weekend and having a massive freaking tarantula put on my face, because I would scream like Daniel Stern if that was me. But even just talking about it, it's like, that's that anecdote you've just said. Hopefully I don't have any including spiders or glue, but it's just a fun film. And the sequel, whatever, but I enjoy this film for what it's worth. It's Chris Columbus. It's a safely directed film, and it's on my list for mainly for those nostalgic reasons, my friend.
All right, so here, I'm just gonna list we'll go back and forth, but I had to start with, it's my favorite movie all time, not just favorite Christmas movie, and it's a movie that I will argue all the time that it is not exclusively a Christmas movie. It does qualify as a Christmas film. The themes are very Christmas-like, and the end of the film, literally the last act, is at Christmas. The rest of the film is not, but it's A Wonderful Life. It is Frank Capra's masterpiece. It is very dark, and a lot of people forget that part of the film, that at the end he is ready to kill himself to get the insurance money to help his family. The sacrifices George will make for his family is ever going. But I raved about this film. I think it is a masterpiece in every way fathomable. As a kid, I watched it a lot, because when I was a kid, it was at the moment, it was in the public domain, and it was on every network for years, and then it vanished. I forgot what happened to the rights. Something did happen, and it vanishes from like the 90s to like the 2000s. They're not showing it like they were. And then I rewatched it, I think, in 2017 after not seeing it for like 20 years. And I cried so much. I was so not ready to connect with everything about the film. And I just had a memory of it as a kid. Like, I knew the basic story and whatnot, but it didn't resonate with me as a kid. It resonates with me so much now. I've taught this film now. It is, I go to see it usually every year in the theater, because they do a lot of retro screenings of it. I try to catch it on the big screen when I can, but it is a movie since 2017 I watch every year. I can't help it. I love it. I quote it. I have stuff for it. My wife, anytime she finds anything with It's a Wonderful Life, she tends to buy it. It's a movie that I can't describe how important I think it is. I just think it is a film that, again, many, many people have seen. I'm not the only person who talks so highly of it, obviously, but I do think there's a generation of people who aren't being shown It's a Wonderful Life, and that's a shame. And listeners, do not watch the colorized version. It's an unauthorized colorization that Ted Turner did when it was under the public domain, and it looks terrible. Just watch the black and white. It's better. It's how it was designed. That's what Frank Capra was going for. That said, it's a classic, and my favorite.
Yeah, I mean, I can't add any more to It's a Wonderful Life. If you haven't seen it, do watch it this holiday season, but or like John, all year round. But do watch it this festive season. It's like you said, it is a dark film, because obviously the kind of defining point of the film is a very dark decision that the character is weighing up, and it's so well directed. The screenplay is excellent. The dialogue is great. That the antagonist, Mr. Potter, is there's many Mr. Potters nowadays, so hey, look, the film is relevant as much now as it has been before, maybe, but it's a fantastic film, and yeah, I mean, I can't speak any more highly than John can. It's a brilliant film. If you haven't seen it, watch it this Christmas, and we hope you won't be disappointed, but I don't think you will be.
What about you, Bo? What's one of your holiday favorites?
I'm going to throw in the next one, JB. Second film I ever saw at the theater. And I know how much you enjoy this film, JB, The Muppets Christmas Carol.
Saw it in the theater?
I did.
Dude, I didn't even know this movie existed till like 5 years ago.
No way. I saw this in the theater. I saw Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, The Secrets of the Ooze, classic. I saw that in a place called Bracknell, about half an hour away, because we didn't have a theater in my hometown, which we do now. And then the next one I saw was this one, The Muppet Christmas Carol, directed by Brian Henson, which is the best Christmas Carol story out there.
Yes, 100%.
The best Ebenezer Scrooge of Michael Caine. Michael 100%. Caine, you've seen the meme. I'm sure I've seen the meme. Michael Caine is out there acting his ass off to get that Oscar, surrounded by puppets. And Michael Caine's like, no, I'm going to drop the hardest performance of the year. He embodies everything about Scrooge throughout, until, of course, the spoiler, he doesn't, and sees the light at the end. He is so damn good in this film. And it seems to be getting a renaissance, or I don't think there's a renaissance, or more of an appreciation in recent years. Just this year alone, or this month, or we're only a week into it, I've seen quite a few memes or comments about The Muppets Christmas Carol. Mainly in a kind of humorous terms, but all in reverence and love. And I love seeing that, like even things just championing and celebrating Rizzo the Rat. You know, does your film have Rizzo? Yeah. No? Well, it isn't a film. That kind of stuff. And I dig it. And it's such a touching film. And it's so emotional, like with Tiny Tim in this as well. The way they, that damn puppet and his damn walking cane. But it gets me every single time. Even the older I get now, and the more soft and soppy I get with stuff like this, it hits even harder. But it's everything I said up top about a film which should give you hope, should give you heart, should make you smile, can make you cry. And hey, look, Scrooge can scare you if you want as well. Everything's in this film, and it's a damn Muppets, yeah, which bring it every year for Christmas for me. And I will be watching this one with my daughter. And guess what, John? It's an hour and 25 minutes long. It doesn't overstay its welcome. The songs are great. I can't wait to watch it again this year.
It also really tells the story despite that. Like, I don't remember. I think Zemeckis is about the same amount of time. But like this, it feels like it's such a detailed story to be so short. You get such a sense of all of it. And my wife loves Miss Piggy. She's a huge, huge Miss Piggy fan. I have above my head Miss Piggy merchandise, in fact.
And, voiced by Yoda.
When we found this movie a few years ago, I was so stoked. I was like, I've never seen this. I think we rented it even from like Redbox or something. Like it was somewhere.
Nice.
And I'm like, how do I not know this movie? And we watched it, and I've thought, you know, we'll watch it because it's Muppets. It'll be fine. And I was like blown away. I'm like, this is incredible.
It's so immediately good, bought it. Isn't it?
It's so good. Michael Caine is phenomenal. And I love, I have seen all the memes of him like playing it. Like everyone's telling the story as if they've discovered it. But like, Michael Caine plays this as straight as possible. And that's what makes it so good, though, is because the Muppets are the Muppets. And honestly, Gonzo as Dickens is incredible. Like, yeah. I love him in this. They released, listeners, if you're a fan of this and you are also a collector of Funko Pops like myself, they did release the Christmas Carol Funkos this year.
Yes.
And I haven't been buying them, but I had to because we love this movie so much. So we got Miss Piggy, we got Kermit, who comes with Tiny Tim, and we got Gonzo, who comes with Rizzo. And I actually got the flocked Gonzo from Amazon. So nice. A little inside baseball there. I am a collector of the stupid Funkos. I have so many.
When I saw that, I remember saying to you, I would be disappointed, flabbergasted, bewildered, and all these over-the-top words if you didn't get those pops. And it turns out you did.
I haven't ordered Scrooge yet. I kind of want to. And they have the old guys, I can't think of their name, Waldorf. They have them as the ghost, as a two-pack. And I really want to get that, but it's like, it's more because it's the two-pack. I'm like, I don't want to, $25. But anyways, we could talk about that movie forever. We both are huge fans.
Yes.
What's Muppet Christmas Carol. I want to give this one a shout out. I've probably talked about this, but this one's relatively recent. It came out in 2017. Wow, I didn't realize it was 2017. Anna and the Apocalypse is a zombie Christmas musical, folks, and that is the key here. It's three genres that you wouldn't think could mesh together, and man, does it. It's so much fun. If you're thinking, I don't like musicals, give this a chance, because it's also, I guess I should also point out, it's a dark comedy zombie Christmas musical. So, like, there's a sense of humor. It's not being completely sincere, although that doesn't mean there's no emotion. It's still a Christmas movie, so there's Christmas themes that are embedded in it. The opening song, though, is one of my favorites, or one of the opening songs. I might be jumping ahead. When it becomes a zombie movie, and the first song that happens is one of my favorite, like, sequences. I just love how it plays out. The choreography of the sequence is a lot of fun. I've shown that scene many times. I've never shown the whole film to students, but I've always, there's one, that opening musical number I've shown a dozen times, because it's one, I like to pique an interest, and I feel like that scene does. And I think just saying zombie Christmas musical piques the interest of many people. I know musical, that genre does turn some people away. That is a mistake. Please give genres a chance. There is a movie for everybody. You just have to find it. Not every musical works for me, but the ones that do, man, do they. And this one's one that works for me. Because Christmas time, I think we associate Christmas and singing, right? Like, there's so many, even in the movies that don't have a musical component, there is Christmas music that we find important and relevant. One of the things I love about The Muppet Christmas Carol, I love the songs in that movie so much. I think all of them really work, which is surprising. And Anna and the Apocalypse, very same. Not all the songs are my favorite, but the ones that work really, really work. It's got a fun tone. And it is a zombie movie. Like, it does hold true. It's not just, like, using zombies as set dressing. Like, it is a real zombie. Like, if you are a fan of that genre, it succeeds at being a really well-made zombie film on top of being a really well-made Christmas film on top of being a really well-made musical. It's just a great movie that I don't think enough people have seen. So I wanted to throw that out there. Anna and the Apocalypse, check it out.
Yeah, agreed. Ella Hunt as Anna is also very good in the film. It's right up my street. That I, like you, I've kind of grown to appreciate musicals more in the recent decade, shall we say.
Mm-hmm. It's on Shudder right now.
There you go. Well, we're not sponsored by Shudder again, but we're going to mention it. It's on Prime really in the UK, which is Shudder. We should be. We gave you guys a whole month of promotion, but yeah, it is on Shudder. Check it out. I enjoy it. I like zombie films. I like Christmas films. And if I can mix them all up, great. But no, like John said, it's very much worth a watch. My final one, JB, probably my favourite Christmas film, because it's very much my up my street in terms of the genre. It's one of the first film, I think, that ever scared the living daylights out of me when I was about four years old. Gremlins from 1984. I remember seeing this as a kid, and it scared me, like the bit at the end, you know, before we go to bed, look under your bed, check in your closet, there might be a gremlin there. Put the fear, I can't tell you, I'll keep, you know, it put the fear of God and the devil and everything holy in me. I remember my family watched it downstairs and I had to come upstairs and lay on my bed all night because I could not watch it because I was scared to death. And then watching it as a teen and adult, it's great. I love it. It's probably my favourite one for entertainment reasons. There's loads of films I haven't mentioned. I mean, if you want to keep it, genre,
so many.
Black Christmas, Krampus, and even like Spirited last year, bit too long, really enjoyed it, and A Christmas Chronicle, Kurt Russell, really enjoyed that. But Gremlins, though, I think Gremlins works on so many levels as a Christmas film. Firstly, it's set at Christmas, of course it is, but the Joe Dante and his themes here, it's about consumerism, it's about commercialism, which is actually kind of like symbolized by the gremlins themselves. And it talks about the dangers of such. There's so much Christmas music throughout. It's played, where is it? It's, Kingston Falls. Sorry. So it's set in the days leading up to Christmas. There's something about it that just makes it one that I will always go back to, maybe because Gizmo in a Santa hat is always only ever going to be cute. But like Anna and the Apocalypse, in terms of branching out, does it work as a Christmas film? For me, 100% Gremlins does. Does it work as a comedy? Absolutely, it does. Does it work as a horror? Well, it damn well did as a kid, so that's a tick for me. So it it branches out into its different genres and different pigeonholes and cubbyholes, and it works in every single one of them. But there is a lesson there. Like you mentioned with It's a Wonderful Life, and I don't think I'm going to compare the two films here. Gremlins and It's a Wonderful Life, but they have important messages, and I do think the commercialism message throughout Gremlins is one that gets overlooked sometimes. And the idea that, hey, look, maybe Christmas isn't for you. Maybe this isn't your time. You're not having a good time, or it brings up bad memories. The film touches on stuff like that as well. It also touches on what it's like to be a parent at Christmas, having to buy the next best thing. But there's so many cool things about Gremlins I love about this. It's absurd. It's funny. It's creepy at times, certainly for the young'uns. But it works so well as a Christmas film. And it also just feels cold. Every time I watch it, the amount of snow, I don't know how they've shot, the way they shoot the actual winter scenes looks so damn cold. Maybe it's because the characters have all got big coats on all of the time. But my man, Gremlins is a film which I absolutely love, absolutely enjoy, have done for many years when I'm not sitting there getting scared of it. Zach Gallagher, everybody loved Phoebe Cates, Corey Feldman, come on, it's great. And you're a fan of Gremlins as well, I want to say.
I am. It's been a long time since I watched it last, though. I am a fan, though. Especially, I just love the design, right? Gizmo is just such a iconic look. Yeah. Although, yes, there is a furry Yoda there, for sure. But, you know, it's around the same time. It's only a couple years off from when Yoda shows up. But and the Gremlins are terrifying. And you know what? I like the second one too. The second one goes wild, but some of the Gremlin designs are just so cool. Like, Sean is out of the elevator, everybody. It's good news.
Good stuff. Well done, Tuna.
But yeah, definitely a fan. I need to rewatch it though. It's been a minute, and Joe Dante has been on my mind lately. So need to. I haven't seen enough of his movies.
Check it out, my friend. Gremlins 2 was actually, I can't remember what the story was now, but he basically wrote it as a middle finger to the studio. That's why it's so wildly different and absurdly different to the first one. There was some kind of issue with the studio, and that was his response to basically give him the big F you and put out Gremlins 2. But now it's so weird, but it's got this huge cult status now following where maybe it didn't when it first came out.
Well, for my last one we're going to talk about today, I mean, I could go on and on because I have seen a lot of Christmas movies. In fact, I'm going to include in the show notes a link to a list on Letterboxd where I am kind of constantly adding things I've seen and ranking them for Christmas movies. And I've seen a lot. I mean, I've seen more than even on this list, but these are the ones that I could remember seeing. And I tend to not count the Hallmark ones because I don't usually sit and watch those. There is one exception. There's a Brandon Routh one where he has a cat that I like a lot. I don't know why. The movie I want to last mention, I believe, is still on Netflix because it is a Netflix original. It accordingly is. It also has one of my favorite funny men, Jason Schwartzman, in the lead, and it's from 2019 called Klaus. I can't believe this movie's that old, to be honest. It feels like I just watched it for the first time like a year ago, but apparently it was four years ago? It's an animated film that I love the look of it. I love the character design. And one of the things that I don't think you get a lot of with Christmas movies is there's actually a twist in the story that you don't know you're getting. Jason Schwartzman, J.K. Simmons, who is phenomenal as Klaus. I do believe it's pronounced Klaus.
Yes,
you get Rashida Jones, Joan Cusack, Norm Macdonald. Oh, man. Rest in peace. Will Sasso, and a bunch of other people who I don't know, but those names are all big for me. I love Joan Cusack anyways. I remember when it first came out, I was not super drawn to it at first. And then I was like, oh, well, it's Schwartzman. I love Schwartzman. And, obviously I also love Simmons, but Schwartzman, I'm just all in the bag on anytime he's, especially if he's getting comedy. And this character has the Schwartzman energy, right? He's bitter. He's a little sarcastic. He's a little entitled, and he's just really good in that zone. And man, this movie works. I wasn't sure, cause I watched it when it came out and I really liked it a lot. And I went back and I was really worried. I was like, man, I hope this lands as much as it did the first time. And I was pleasantly surprised that it did. I will probably rewatch it this year. I've only seen it twice, but it's a movie that I know a lot of people saw it because of Netflix, but I also know how Netflix tends to work and people forget things are there. And that kills me with a great movie like this. I wanted to remind people that it's there because it's not going to get played on TBS for 24 hours because it's a Netflix movie. So if you don't actively look it up to watch it, you might just forget about it. And it deserves to be remembered. I think it deserves to be on that pantheon of a movie we come back to year after year. Because it is quality and it hits the Christmas spirit, I think, real, real hard. And it's a Christmas origin story and a non-religious Christmas origin story. I don't want to offend anyone. Obviously, Christmas is centered around the birth of Jesus. For most people, this is more about the birth of the Christmas traditions of Santa Claus, right? And I think it's worth checking out.
Yeah, it's everything I want in a Christmas film. It gives me that warm feeling, John. It's funny. It makes me feel good. There is a little bit of creepy in there as well. I'm here for it, JB. I haven't watched this one with my kid yet, but I feel like I might also put her onto this one this year as well because I think she'll dig this. And also, I want to watch it as well. I have seen it. I will just say that again. But like you, it's one I haven't revisited and. Not for any reason other than I just haven't revisited, but I'd like to watch the one again this year. So maybe that'll be a pre-Christmas viewing, JB. But pretty solid list there. And like we said, there's so many more. You've got your Letterboxd list there. There's so many more. Kind of, I mean, we've mentioned Die Hard for a joke, of course. But hey, look, who knows whether that is or isn't? I think it is. People would put that in there. There are so many classic, like The Santa Claus, the Dudley Moore one, what's the guy called, Buzz, like Tim Allen, there's those films, Miracle on 34th Street, I mentioned Kurt Russell, Christmas Chronicle, another Netflix film. There's so many that you could throw on there.
I would love for you to do the same and make your own letterbox list if you have some time. If it's late, we can always tweet it out or something, because there are so many. And my rankings, well, most of the time when I rate a movie on Letterboxd, it is like, I think it's a must-see movie or a quality movie. And Christmas movies get a different type of rating because some are just, I may not like hold some of them up to like Citizen Kane, even though they both have 5 stars. Mm-hmm. But as far as like, does it deliver what I'm looking for this time of year? Yes, this is a movie that makes me feel the magic of Christmas, which is something that I really will always be grateful for my mom really instilling in me is the magic of Christmas. Like I really do try to treat this time of year with a special vibe, a special approach. Right. And these movies help get me there.
Yeah. And it can be hard as well. Sometimes Christmas it's for many reasons for different people as well. And we also acknowledge that it's not everybody's favorite season. We get that as well. But if a Christmas film can deliver anything, we hope it can deliver at least a little bit of warmth, for everybody out there. And yeah, like you, I have to sometimes rate films based on what they give me. I don't want to say a 5-star film is better than The Godfather 2 or something like that because I've given it a different rating. No, this is what I felt at the time. Christmas films, they do need to be rated differently because I could give Gremlins a 5. I don't think I would, but I can give it a 5 and there'll always be someone who says, well, hold on, you only gave Oppenheimer a 4.5. It doesn't work like that, guys. It's about the feeling. So yeah, I will get one of those lists done, JB, and I'll get it over to you ASAP.
Perfect. And we'll get that out to you listeners.
Yes, sir. But yeah, good lists. Always enjoy talking about Christmas films. We only get to do it for a few weeks a year.
Yeah, which is why I thought we'd start with that. But now it's time to end the concessions of a cinephile and move on to media consumption. This is movie, TV, video games, podcasts, etc. It's mostly going to be movies that we have experienced to pass the time between recordings. Matt, what have you been consuming?
I've been listening to the Double Toasted podcast and the YouTube channel. Again, watching the Bad Movie Roast and listened to Nightmare on Film Street, where they spoke about a Wes Craven film of which I've already forgotten what it's called. I also listened to the horror show talking about 30 Days of Night. I've been listening to a few things, but in terms of films, I've watched a few new ones, one via the cinema, one via link, and one via rental. So I saw Wish. Didn't see it with my kid yet, but I saw it before. Because I sort of asked if you wanted to see it. I seemed a little bit kind of nonplussed by it just by looking at the trailer, but I might try again next week because It's not a very long film. It clocks in about 90 minutes. I'm not going to lie. It's not a film I'd be rushing to see again because I think it's just okay. But, you know, that's coming from a late 30-year-old guy's eyes. I think Ariana DeBose is good in it. I don't want to sound like that guy that is saying the same as everybody else, but which I never want to, but I have to. For me, it's just ho-hum. There isn't the magic, the spark, the joy, the wonder. It's not there in this film, and that's what I expect from a Disney film. This is, what, the 100th anniversary of Disney, I think they're saying, and man, there's so many other... I would have been happy if they just re-released one of the old classics instead and said, to celebrate, we're going to do a marathon of the old classics, because this doesn't stack up for me. It's fine. It's okay. It's middling at best. It wasn't great. And I take no joy in saying that as somebody who is a big fan traditionally of Disney films. I saw Next Girl Wins, thanks to a link, and... Yeah, we still haven't got that great soccer film, have we? That great football film. I didn't find it particularly funny. Some parts were. Some parts got me. You know, there's a few lines in it which really got me. But again, I just there's something about it which just didn't grab me. And actually, that goes for the next film. I know, John, I think you thought the film was the same. But Next Girl Wins, Taika Waititi, Michael Fassbender. Come on, Fassbender. It's good in the film, but I want the Fassbender of... like a decade ago when he was just smashing these absolute belters out. Next Girl Wins is okay. It's disappointing. I'd probably even go as far as to say it's not what I thought it was going to be. Same as Strange Way of Life. I think I remember this, only a short-ish film. I seem to remember you saying, JB, that you watched this and maybe expected more from certain elements of it.
From Next Girl Wins?
A Strange Way of Life, the Pedro Pascal.
Okay. Well, I thought he chickens out because you get these two big actors and they're gay lovers and they don't interact in any way that it would feel gay, but the younger versions of them do. And it's like, oh, how do you get these two guys? And then they won't do the scene.
But you'll put them on the poster there and you'll market it as a gay film. But the two leads, I believe Ethan Hawke and Pedro Pascal would have been more than up for it because they are men of their craft, and if it would have helped the narrative. And I'm with you on that. I think it's pretty good, but I do think something's holding it back. And at the end, it kind of felt Much Ado About Nothing. Really, it's not something I came away from feeling particularly enlightened or empowered or satisfied by. It's okay. So. Film-wise this week, it's been a bit middling. Next Girl Wins, I wasn't the biggest fan of. Didn't hate it. I was a little bit disappointed by it. Wish, very similar. It just kind of... It flew along nicely because it's not very long, but nothing jumped out at me. I wasn't taken by it. A Strange Way of Life was good, but it could have been more, which I'm pretty sure is a Pedro Pascal meme as well. So, not the best week for films. There's a few, though, that I know you've seen, one specifically, which I'm very, very excited to see next week. So I'm hoping, beyond all hope, that next week my list is going to be a lot more positive. But that's pretty much me for this week, John, because I've had, which I'll mention shortly, I've had a busy few days and a busy weekend. So I've only been able to see these films. But you, my man, have been as busy as...
Yeah, I'm working through a lot of stuff. If I wrote a review, I will mention that I wrote a review. You can find that either at BurkeReviews.com or Disappointment Media. I will almost always rank things on Letterboxd, though, at least with the star rating. So if you just want to kind of get my general thoughts, you can check that out. And I tend to post those onto Instagram stories, although I haven't been great about that. I'm going to make an effort to, like, every time I log something, to post it on my Instagram so you can at least see my thoughts. But I've watched Sanctuary, which is listed as a 2022 movie, but is in the neon box for this year. So it is eligible for awards this year. I didn't know what that was. Wild movie. Dream scenario. Honestly, one of my more disappointed films of the year. I was really hyped for this, and it really didn't work for me tonally. I was annoyed, I think, more than anything throughout the film. I don't like Nick Cage's character, and it's not the performance. He's doing what he should be doing. It just, like, grated my the whole being. I was like, I want this to end. I don't want to be with this guy for the whole movie. And you're with the guy for the whole movie, which again is kind of the point of the character, but it made it an unpleasant watch for me. So didn't love it. The Peasants, which is one of those, it's a rotoscope film where it's all oil color over actual like actors. Same people that did the Vincent Van Gogh film that way a couple years ago, which I've never seen, but it's supposed to be pretty good. It's beautiful. I wasn't really like hooked into the story. It's a period piece. Didn't really grab me that way. Mm-hmm. I got to see The Iron Claw. We are under embargo for that still, but my review will be up at Burke Reviews for that one. Godzilla Minus One. I am sad to say for the CACF, it is not eligible for our awards because it was not screened for us, and that is part of the requirements. And I think it would easily lock in international and probably be up for Best Picture. Godzilla Minus One is one of the best movies I've seen this year, hands down. It's so good. We might have reviewed it, but I really want to encourage everyone, if you can see it in the theater, let Japan know that American audiences will watch their movies if we get the opportunity, because it is so good, folks. It's a great Godzilla movie, but it's a great movie. Like, you care about the characters. There's emotions, there's stakes, there's growth. It's incredible in every way. And especially when I have not fact checked this, but my understanding is it's a $15 million budget.
It isn't a big budget. I know that.
It does not feel like it's a $15 million budget, and it puts to shame some of these $100 million, $200 million blockbusters. This movie looks incredible, especially with that budget. It's nuts. Also, lots of Jaws in Godzilla Minus One that makes me, as a fanatic of Jaws, I'm just like watching it going, they made this for me. So can't stress enough how great that movie is. Go see it. Silent Night, the new John Woo film with what's his face? Yep, I don't remember his name.
You've got Rick Flag.
Rick Flag.
Oh, Joe Kinnaman.
That's it. Yeah, Silent Night sucks. It's real bad. It's real freaking bad. It's so bad. It's 90-minute movie. The middle 30 minutes is a broken up training montage. That's not a montage. It's like literally like 3 minutes of him doing bad chin-ups and kettlebell routines. And it goes on for like 20 minutes. And then the very first thing that happens after all of 20 minutes of training is he gets his butt kicked. So the training was pointless. Like,
excellent.
There's so much wrong with this movie. And I don't know. Do you know the conceit of Silent Night? Why it's called Silent Night?
I do now, because I think we mentioned it on last week's show, and I didn't know that. But it doesn't come out here until the 23rd of December, so I'm not going to rush to see it.
A spoiler, but more so, like, his character gets shot in the throat in the first like 3 minutes, so it makes sense that he can't speak. It doesn't make sense that every other character in the movie doesn't speak. For the most part, there's no true dialogue. There's a few characters who exclaim something, but it's like even drowned out a little bit. But like, there's some characters who words are said, but it most of the time just feels like an awkward, like, why did you choose to do this? This is the second film this year that has done that, mind you. The other one works way better. I forget the Caitlin Dever Hulu.
Oh, no one will save you.
Yeah. Like, that conceit, there's a couple of moments where you're like, they would have spoke there. This movie, it's like they would be talking. There would be someone in the area talking. It makes no sense. The action's not tremendous. It's a, you know, for John Woo's return, it is a huge disappointment. Caught Eileen, Thomasin.
Yes, I am.
I was struggling to, like, I was like, wait, where does the Asin part go? And then Anne Hathaway. It's an interesting movie. I don't know how I feel about it. It's interesting. I'm under embargo for the next thing, but Merry Little Batman is dropping on Amazon Prime this week. My review will be up at Disappointment Media. It is a 90-minute animated feature going right to Prime. Luke Wilson is the voice of Batman. I forget the actor who's voicing Damian Wayne, but he's a young actor. James Cromwell is Alfred. It's a kids cartoon, like first and foremost, it is meant for a younger audience, but much like the Lego Batman movie, there is a lot of Batman references. So fans like me who have seen all the Batman movies, maybe too many times, you're going to be like, oh, there's that. You're the Leonardo DiCaprio meme. You're just pointing at the screen going, there's the phone from the Adam West Batman. Like, it's stuff like that. I won't say if it's good or bad because that's the embargo. I'm not even sure if I might have said too much. It's whatever. The Royal Hotel, I caught thanks to the Neon book. Good movie. Fallen Leaves, a foreign film. I think German, if I remember correctly.
So.
It might be Norwegian. I can't remember. It's something very quirky. It sometimes I have a hard time getting tone when it's in a different language, because I'm not sure if it's like a cultural thing where, like, do people talk like that in their culture, or is this a like Yorgos Lanthimos style characters say exactly what they're thinking and there's no like civility, you know, like you're kind of ugly, like, you know what I'm saying, like that, like the lobster bluntness. And that, my understanding is there is that kind of quirky tone in this movie, and so it mostly worked for me. And then I watched Jonathan Glazer's The Zone of Interest.
Ooh, okay, what do you think?
Man, it's a very hard film to articulate exactly how I feel, but there's a lot,
isn't it?
There's a lot of like art house avant-garde stuff embedded in a very traditional looking film, but also not a traditional looking film because of how it is shot. The camera work in it is unique intentionally. The story is devastating for interesting ways. Like, it is, I have talked about David Ehrlich a million times, but yeah. His review, I don't always agree with him in terms of what he said.
Always well written, though.
But I am always so impressed with how he articulates, and I think this might be the pinnacle of that. His opening paragraph for his review of The Zone of Interest is a masterpiece of his talent, and I think he does a great job of explaining the power of the film. And he only gave it 4.5 stars out of 5, mind you, which I think is, it's always so shocking to me because he will rave about how great a film is. And I'm looking at like a 3.5 star rating. I'm like, where is your 5? Like, how do you get a 5 from David Ehrlich? But, it's a movie that I think sits with you, for a long time.
It's
afterward.
A Glazer film. That's Jonathan Glazer all over. He doesn't do anything conventionally or by numbers. And
I don't want to say what it is because I feel like I knew more than I was supposed to. I wish I hadn't read the synopsis because I think the synopsis.
I know nothing about it.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Yeah. I don't want to say anything then.
One I've wanted to see because Under the Skin is like sensational.
Holy crap!
But it's a trip, and as are all of his films. Will not be for everyone. We say that it is very much. It will have a vibe, but will not.
And I do love
Under the Skin. Yeah, so and ScarJo is so good. This is one of the ones I've been looking forward to this year, The Zone of Interest, because I know I'm either going to really be attracted to it, or I'm just going to not like it. And that's what I love about someone like Glazer. I like some of the things he's done. But I'm not a sicker fan who is going to rave about everything.
Yeah,
I could watch this and think, man, this is high art crap. Or I could be saying up the opposite, and I can't wait to see it, my man.
I will say, I think the reviews I've read helped me kind of formulate my take on it. But
okay,
because there are things in it that I'm like, why that, and I needed to read someone else's interpretation. Because I didn't have an answer, and I don't know. Obviously, it's an interpretation, so I don't know for sure if the people who I've read are getting what Glazer is going for. But I like their take enough that I'm like, okay, well, that justifies that decision in a way that I think elevates the film for me. All right. So, and then I haven't been playing too many other things, but I have been playing the new season of Speedstorm because we got Frozen Racers, Matt, which I mentioned to you, but it's 5. They dropped 5 new racers, all from Frozen. So basically all of the major characters from the first movie. You got Kristoff, Anna. I don't have Anna yet. She's the only one I don't have yet. Elsa, Olaf, and surprisingly, the guy who tries to marry Anna in the first movie.
Hans.
Yeah, the villain, like, and he's they're all pretty good, and the Frozen themed tracks are awesome. I really like the Frozen themed tracks. And I don't know if you've noticed the renditions of the Disney songs for the game, that like they're a little bit like electronic, like up tempo. The Let It Go version is awesome. Like I'm really vibing with that song. So yeah, if you're not too burnt out on Frozen, Matt, I know you had a much different experience with that film than I did. I didn't have to rewatch it to the level that you did.
That was COVID, the worst part about COVID. And I like Frozen, man. And I like Frozen 2.
Oh,
like,
good movie.
I think they're good films, but during COVID, I had to watch it. One would finish, the other would go on, and then the same one would then go back on, and then the other one would go on, and it was like hell on earth. It was like the end of A Clockwork Orange. I just sat there with my eyes pinned open watching these things. But I do like the films, and I haven't played the new Frozen version, Fruit Tracks and Speedstorm, but I'm actually quite excited just to hear the tunes now and kind of bop along as I'm driving.
Yeah. That's a game I think would be a fun gateway game for Olivia too, because it's Disney friendly and it's a lot of fun. Mario Kart's always fun. But that's our media consumption, folks. I did watch a lot of movies. Again, I'm not going to go into detail. I probably talked more about each of them than I meant to. But
it's classic.
Bamp. Before we close the show, before we say goodbye, we have to check in to make sure we are staying bloody awesome. So, Matt, I need to know, how were you staying bloody awesome this week?
Well, I've been getting into the festive spirit, JB, in different ways. My God, I'm very excited to hear what yours is about, because I think I've got the wrong end of the stick already. But my company had their Christmas party last Thursday at a cocktail bar called the Anthologist in Bank in London, just a nice part of London. Everything was laid on, free bar all night, wonderful. I enjoy some rum, had a good evening there. Good vibes, good spirit, kind of kicked off December and the festive season nicely. It's Christmas party, it's just fun, have a dance, have a good time. And then on Saturday, similar to you, I went to a festive themed event here in the UK. It's quite, trying to work out how to describe it. It's called Glow. It's in a place called Wisley. It's this really nice vast gardens, and it is I don't really know how to explain it. It's a kind of a light show. It's a trail where they light up these gardens in lights and strobe lights and music, special effects and all that. I can't really explain much more than that. I mean, I didn't really put many pictures up, but I've been trying to go for the last few years, but they're always sold out. It's always booked up early. So I thought, well, maybe I should do the same. So I booked it up early and went with a kid. We went about 7 in the evening, and my God, it was the coldest night of the year by far.
Oh, man.
I think I caught a chill for the next 2 days. However, it was a lot of fun going around, seeing the cool lights, getting some cool pictures. A lot of it is there for, you know, photo opportunities, but it's so cool. It's a lovely garden, great setting. The lights they put on and the effort they do to make this thing look incredible is admirable. And it ain't cheap. The amount they charged me for a mulled wine or a hot chocolate was extortionate, but fine. But I really enjoyed that, other than the cold. So yeah, Christmas party and then a Christmas light trail thing on Saturday evening, and then I've got a few more things planned in the coming weeks to get further into the Christmas spirit, JB. But that's what I've been doing to stay bloody awesome, and I cannot wait to hear what yours is, because I have got the wrong end of the stick.
So I mentioned that we went to this Pioneer thing. Before we left for it, I'm looking at the list of activities, and one of the things that I see on the list is skunk hug. And my wife loves animals, and she has always thought skunks were so cute. And there's like tons of like TikTok videos of people who have like wildlife that maybe shouldn't be pets as pets, right? And a skunk can be deglanded so that it can't shoot the stinky stuff. Yes. And that's what this is. These are it's a rescue, who this group of people, they rescue skunks. They have been deglanded, and you pay $3 and the money goes to the organization, and you get to sit in a chair and hold a skunk. And I have seen my wife happy many, many times. I knew this would be one of the biggest smiles I'd ever see on her face, and I was so, so right. I had to buy a bag of candied almonds to get change so that she could go and hold a skunk. And my wife is among four children like, and I mean like eight or less, who are currently doing this at this moment. So like there's like five chairs. It's four kids and then one of their parents is doing it, and my wife's having to wait, and she's waiting so patiently, but I can see on her face that she is like, I need to hold that skunk. And there's multiple skunks. There's like, I think they had two albino skunks, so like all white skunks, and they had very traditional like Pepe Le Pew black and white skunk, and then a brown skunk with the white stripes. And she started with the brown one, got to hold the brown one, and it's just huge grin, just like she's so excited. I am not holding skunk. I am eating a bag of candied almonds, which I didn't know I liked as much as I do. It's one of those things I've always smelled, like there every Christmas season, right? There's the candied nut guy in the mall, and I'm like, that smells good. I don't want to pay $6 for a bag of almonds or cashews or pecans that are basically just covered in sugar.
Yes.
I did this so I could get cash to give her to hold the skunk. So I got the almonds. I ate the almonds. They were delicious. I'm watching and I am like, okay, I gotta get pictures. So she got to not only hold the brown one, but then they also gave her the black and white skunk. And both times she was just so excited. I'm probably lucky that she didn't try to steal one. I was a little worried that she would just try to run with one, because like, what are the other chances you're going to ever have one in your arms that you could take? And I also, I'm not sure if she started looking to see if she could work for these people. Like, I feel like I might've accidentally stumbled upon something that will become a bigger part of our life, but for the moment she's satisfied with just the hug. And yeah, it made the basically a 2.5 hour drive there and back total so much money to get. It was way more expensive to get into this thing than it should have been, because we were only there for like an hour and a half. We could have been there for like 4 hours, but there was, we had done everything in an hour and a half, and I didn't have endless money to keep letting her hug the skunks. Also, at some point I feel like they would have been like, lady, you have to go home. And but yeah, so that's how I say Blood Awesome was getting to see my wife overjoyed with holding a skunk. Yeah, it was great.
You are a husband we'd all want to say was our own JB for the just for that story. It's very I had a big grin on my face hearing that, how happy you were to see your wife's happiness. And also because I'm glad it didn't mean what I thought it meant when I read the word skunk hug.
Yeah, I'm curious. I don't want to know, but I'm guessing you thought maybe I got sprayed by a skunk.
Well, I mean, I don't know about the US, but skunk is another word for cannabis in the United Kingdom.
Oh!
And I was like, oh my God, I mean, JB's had a warm hug from a smoke.
I guess it's a term used to describe like bad weed here in the States. Like skunky weed is okay. Yeah. Yeah. I guess we don't usually hear it just as skunk though. It's like skunky weed or skunky.
Goodness.
Weed.
You had a much more.
Although also thing. I'm also like not in that world. So maybe I just don't know what I'm talking about, but you know, whatever.
Yes, I'm here, but don't advocate that whatsoever, but it's just out there in the zeitgeist. And I thought,
yes,
on earth has JB been doing?
That said, folks, that's our episode for this week. We talked Saltburn. We were going to have a spoiler episode drop in a couple of days. It hopefully will be a lot shorter than this one. If everything goes well, we're going to be talking about the new Hayao Miyazaki film, the first time ever, because he hasn't released one since we've been doing this podcast. The Boy and the Heron is going to be released in theaters. I do have a theater I can go to. It's not coming as of the moment. It's not listed to come to the mall that I live near, and it's so aggravating. But fortunately, it is coming to the theater near where I work, and I will be able to see it there. So as far as I know, as long as Matt's able to see The Boy and the Heron, that is what we're going to be talking about on our next episode.
Very much looking forward to it. I've been trying to get through as many Miyazaki / Ghibli films as possible just over the last few years. It's kind of like catch up on the watch list. So I'm very excited to kind of be there for the properly for the opening of a new film.
I've seen all of Hao's films. I have not seen all of the Ghibli films, but I've seen all of Hayao Miyazaki's films because Blank Check covered him a few years ago, and you should listen to those episodes. They're great. In the meantime, folks, you can follow us on social media. On Instagram, we're at Bloody Awesome Movie Pod, and on X, where can they find us, Matt?
We are at BAMP underscore podcast, BAMP underscore podcast.
You can still find us on Facebook if you just search Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast. We are a Rotten Tomatoes approved podcast, so you can see our, I'm guessing, positive tick. We're going to add to the percentages here for this film on the tomato meter. individually, you can follow me at BurkeReviews.com and at BurkeReviews on all the social media platforms. Matt, where can they find you?
WhatIWatchTonight.co.uk, and just search What I Watch Tonight across all of the socials, including Letterboxd.
And if you like what we're doing here at the Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast, we ask that you give us that 5-star rating on whatever podcast catcher you use to listen, because it helps other people find the show. With that, we encourage you to keep watching movies
and stay bloody awesome.